Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks. Normally, every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, you know, fire, flammables, an album that bumps eternally. Today, though, the two of us will be chatting with each other about the year in music.
It's time to wake up. We have walked the walk many years, many times.
What a strange, surreal year it's been. And Morgan, how have these months in lockdown influenced or changed your listening habits, if at all?
Thank you for asking me that. First, I have to say, you couldn't have told me that the last time I would see you this year was in March when we sat down to record the Patrice Rushen episode, which was a beautiful episode. But you couldn't have, I mean, no one could have predicted this, but when I think back on just those last moments in the box with you, it was just a great episode to have it be the last one where we would see each other. How my listening habits have changed. They've changed dramatically because I didn't know that I would miss live shows as much. I guess you never miss your water to the well runs dry because I had so many complaints about live show culture right before this happened. People talking, people texting, people standing at the stage, you know, taking selfies. So I had said to myself, I'm over live shows. And then this happened. And I started missing being able to go to live shows. The last show I saw before the pandemic was actually Thundercat at the Wiltern. And that might have been March the 9th or something. So right before this happened. So since then, I've been listening a lot to live albums to sort of recreate that feeling of being around an audience. And I've been focused on a couple of them. Al Jarreau Live in London from 1984. It's an album that I remember my uncle playing a lot, listening to it as a youth. And so I've been playing a lot of that. And I've been playing Mary J. Blige's live album, which is called The Tour. She's performing a lot of her classics, but she's in L.A. And that album is a wonder. Both of them are a wonder. And I've been listening to Richie Havens' album from 1983. So I've just been trying to recreate this feeling of being around people.
Yeah.
I've also returned to the radio, listening to the radio, because I needed to hear DJs in their element. I needed to hear the back announcing. I just need to feel like I'm around someone experiencing music. So that's how, you know, music has changed for me this year. It's wonderful to be able to listen to music that I don't have to clear.
Yeah.
And there's no pressure on that. So those are the changes for me. What about you?
Well, I was going to say, you know, in the ways in which NBA arenas and NFL stadiums have been piping in crowd noise just to give the audience the sense that things are quote unquote normal, I feel like they should do the same thing for home listeners. And you can pipe in crowd noise, you know, people yelling at bartenders, people saying down in front because you're too tall and you're blocking my view of the stage, just to give it that proper live feeling. Now, in all seriousness, I mean, lockdown has had some really, really major impacts. And I think one of the biggest is the fact that I don't drive to work, which means I'm not in the car anywhere near as often as I was before. And I think like a lot of people in LA, the car is one of the main places in the time that you spend commuting and whatever else. These are major opportunity times to be listening to music. And when I'm home, I've been home most of the time. I don't listen to music while I'm working because I find it too distracting. And so in order to listen to music, I would have to deliberately schedule or carve out time to do that. And to be really blunt and candid, with everything going on, it just wasn't a big priority for me to carve out that time. And it's not like I have empirical data to prove this, but I'm fairly certain that 2020 might have been the year I've listened to new music at least the least amount of time. So relative to last year, the year before that, or going back probably, I don't know, 40 years, I just did not listen to a lot of new music. And I think a lot of it has to do with obviously just kind of the world circumstances, but also some of the specifics around the fact that, like I said, I'm not in the car. I don't have these easy made opportunities to throw on Spotify and see what else has come out. And what's weird here is that it's intellectually weird for me to recognize, yes, I've spent very little time, relatively speaking, listening to new music, but it hasn't felt weird, if that makes sense. So in my head, it feels weird, but in my heart, I'm like, it is what it is. That makes sense?
It does make sense. It does make sense. But I have a question for you. Right before this happened, so right before the pandemic hit, when you were spending time in your car, what was on rotation for you then? Like right before, like the month of March, if you can recall, what you were bumping in March?
Yeah, I'd have to go back and try to see if I can figure it out from my iTunes playlist or Spotify playlist to see what it is that I was rolling with. It would not have been, and I'll talk more about this later in the episode, but it likely would not have been necessarily albums. It might have been individual songs. You know, I'm also curious to know for you, because I thought maybe I would go back to some of my old favorites as a form of comfort listening. And even though we had our comfort music episodes earlier in the spring, but through the rest of 2020, I did not spend as much time on nostalgia trips as I might have predicted. I think my listening became much more sporadic and in some ways circumstantial. So, for example, I might have heard a song in some kind of random context. Maybe it was placed on an ad or something along those lines. And so then on a spur, I might have put that into rotation for a few days or weeks, but then I would move on to something else. And by and large, outside of Heat Rocks, I simply was not spending very much dedicated time listening to music. And that is such a weird thing to hear me say, to come out of my mouth. But, you know, what was 2020, if not a year of really weird things?
100%. And because of work, I had to spend the bulk of my time listening to music. But I think in 2020, I started to compartmentalize music. One was music for work and the other was music for me. And yeah. I needed a way to really access, you know, the feelings that I had about this year and the things that were going on. And for that, I selected, you know, music to feel to, music to cope to. And I separated that from music that I had to do for work.
And so were you deliberately creating time and space for you to do the personal listening that you're talking about?
Yes. And those were those scant few moments that I had when I wasn't working. And it wasn't heavy curation. It was sort of led by nostalgia, which songs, which albums really used to make me feel good, which albums remind me of a time where this was happening or that was happening. So I returned to a lot. I returned to specific years. I returned to 1992 a lot because that marked a big change in my life. So I returned to albums that I was listening to a lot then. What's the 411, Journey with the Lonely, that sort of stuff. So yeah.
I think for me too, part of the reason why I spent less time listening to new music is because there were a few artists that if they had put out new stuff, I would have been on top of instantly. And again, I'm not saying this in any way to suggest that artists are obligated to release whatever, you know, release anything, anytime, whatever. I mean, they can do it on their own volition. But you would have thought that 2020 would have been a great year for, let's say, a new Kendrick Lamar project, right? We are way overdue, I feel, at this point for a Frank Ocean album. You know, it's been 4 years since Blonde came out. And I'm just giving you two artists off the top. There's probably more if I really thought about it. But those two immediately came to mind in terms of, well, if either of them had released something, I would have sat with that 100%.
You know, I have to say, and, you know, I think because we talked about this year. Did we talk about this year? Or whether it's fair or not, I was expecting a Sade album this year. I thought it's been about time. I think Soldier of Love was
not quite 10 years, but the group has certainly been stretching out the time between Sade albums much longer.
Wasn't that 2010?
Was it? Oh my God. Has it been 10 years?
Maybe it hasn't.
No. Christian just gave us a thumbs up on Zoom and yeah, it's been 10, which is wow, because I remember reviewing that album and I didn't realize it's already been a decade. You're right. Sade, what's up? Why are you, you, oh, it's time. It's due.
That's what, that's the thing I was thinking. I have in my mind with Sade, with the band, it's like either 9 or 10 years. And so at some point I was like, see, this is going to be the year.
Right.
And it wasn't. Unless there's a December surprise that awaits us, but
you never know. But this is not really strategically a great time to put out new music, at least not from a marketing sales point of view, but who knows. But before we dig that too deep into that, so the idea behind this episode is that each of us would choose three recordings that stood out to us from 2020. And Morgan, why don't you lead us off?
I will say one of the albums, or two of the albums, because they were released by the same group. And the group is Salt. All right, if I can just read a little bit from their Wikipedia page. Salt are a pseudonymous British music collective that make a mixture of rhythm and blues, house and disco. Despite critical acclaim, they eschew interaction with the media. They frequently foreground black-centric issues. Their first four albums credit Inflow as producer, winner of Ivor Novello Awards for his work on Little Sims' Gray Area, great album, and co-writer as Michael Kiwanuka's Black Man in a White World. That's the extent of their Wikipedia. That's it. And that's about all we know about them. We know that they're a British musical collective. We know that this is their fourth album. They had albums, one called Five, one called Seven. And then they released two albums this year, both this year, Untitled Rise and Untitled Black Is. The way that social media and just information flows right now, I'm surprised that this is all we know about them. They don't do any press. I mean, I'm cool with their publisher, and I still don't know who they are. Shout out to Jason Flavian. But every time we talk about the band, he doesn't give anything else except, here's some new songs that I'd love for you to check out. And I think that's either really clever. They've built this legend around them. But they've been on everybody's lists and lips this year, primarily because of the things that happened this year that affected our social consciousness. Mm. Police brutality, obviously, the murder of George Floyd, the murder of Breonna Taylor. These were two albums that that really underscored the feeling of unrest, the anger, the anxiety, the fatigue, the depression around some of the things that were happening to Black folks in the country. And we've talked at length about protest songs, protest albums for every generation. Whereas I think To Pimp a Butterfly belonged a lot to the millennial generation, I thought these two albums belonged a lot to younger millennials and Generation Z. It felt like, I heard it as a Black Fist.
Yeah.
But I also heard it as a groan, a mumble, a cry. It had all of those things.
We shall be master, our strength. Through millennia, bathed in the tears of 1,000 ancestors, we shall rise. As it was in the beginning, so too shall it be in the end.
I know as little about them as anybody else out there. My awareness of the band is about the same as Wikipedia. But two songs that I listened to a lot were from the Rise album, a song called Scary Times.
These are scary times.
Soundtrack ready.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure that I necessarily would place it, it had that, it was this, it spoke to the things that we couldn't say about how we felt. There was a sense, folks around me, of this collective fatigue that comes after the anger and after the anxiety and the uncertainty. There was just a collective, like, we're just so tired of this. We're just so tired of this story repeating itself. And I thought that that song and other songs on that album spoke to that feeling. Spoke to that feeling that resonated with all of us around some of these shootings. The other song is from their album Black Is. And that is more what I'm talking about when I say that it feels like a Black Fist, that it presents sonically as a Black Fist. And it's called Stop Dim.
We are your radio people, and we are
I'd be very curious to see if any of these songs from either of the albums end up being placed somewhere. But those were two of the albums that kept me going by a band that we don't know much about, which is Salt.
For my pick, my first pick is, as I was saying earlier, I didn't do a ton of dedicated listening this year, but there were some exceptions to that. And one of the first albums that I could think of in 2020 that I went out of my way to sit with was arguably an album that people had been waiting on, not for months, but for literally years, which is J Electronica's very, very long-awaited, long-delayed debut album, A Written Testimony.
They say it was gonna never happen, but I survived Neverland like the Jacksons. You never swallow slanderous lies for the devil's satisfaction. I still got my glitter gloves, I still got my glitter socks. Now I'm moonwalking on your couch with many zippers on my jacket. J Cirque de Soleica. I started on Tatooine, but now I'm way out in the Dagobah.
Morgan, were you a J Elect fan since like the late aughts?
You know what? I would say in theory I was. There was a sense of like waiting, like he's dope, but where's the rest of this? When is the rest of this coming? I liked Exhibit C. I liked Letter to Fallon. But I think I, like everybody else, was like, yo, like I knew he had bars, but I was just waiting so hard for the rest to come out. But in terms of his wordplay, I thought he was prolific. That's why I was waiting.
No, I mean, when J Electronica first hit the scene, I think probably around 08 or 09, I mean, again, we're talking about over a decade ago, I thought he was, and this is very much pun intended, he was electric. He had this, he had then and still does now, he has this fantastic meld where you have this authoritative baritone voice, which I think goes a long way, especially as a rapper. There's obviously layers of spiritual and religious gravitas that he incorporates into his performance persona. And of course, he can rhyme his ass off. And Exhibit C, which you mentioned just a moment ago, I think is still one of the greatest songs of the 20-aughts.
Call me J-Elect Hanukkah, J-Elect Yarmulke, J-Elect Tramadon, Muhammad Asalamaka, Rasulullah Subhanahu Wa Allah through your monitor. My Uzi still weigh a ton, check the barometer. I'm hotter than the motherfucking sun, check the thermometer. I'm bringing ancient mathematics back to modern man. My mama told me never throw a stone and hide your hand.
The anticipation for his, you know, whatever his official debut was going to be, in my mind, I don't want to say that it was equivalent to, let's say, Nas in 94, because it's hard to recreate that moment because hip hop is just much bigger and different this would have been 2009, 2010 compared to then. But nonetheless, there was this idea of you knew the talent was there. So you're just waiting on what the execution was going to sound and look like. And instead, what we got was crickets for a decade, which is really hard to wrap one's head around how long people have been waiting. And so when A Written Testimony finally arrived, while I couldn't resurrect the anticipation that I would have felt towards it 10 years ago, because just too much time has passed, the album to me still delivered enough on the promise that this is someone who has an immense amount of talent. And is also still remains, I think, a great enigma in terms of you're trying to figure out. So what are you trying to do? What is your goal as a recording artist to the extent that you have one? So I think all those things were wrapped up in this album. And then on the side, it's also worth noting is that this album was also like a sneak Jay-Z EP hidden in plain sight, because he's on, you know, half the songs, it feels like.
I got numbers in my phone that'll never ring again, cause a lot done sent them home and they'll never, I got numbers on my phone that'll never ring again, cause a lot done called them home. So until we sing again, I got Texas in my phone that'll never.
So all in all, I thought A Written Testimony was a really solid listen, even though there is this missing decade from his backstory that I want to know a little bit more about. And certainly I hope that this does not, it's not going to be another 10 years between this and his next release. Maybe he's on that Sade tip though. What do I know?
Sleep well. Lately I haven't been sleep well.
I even hit the beach to soak my feet and skip some seashells. Sleep well, the lump inside my throat sometimes is towers like the Eiffel. Sometimes I wonder, do the trees get sad when they see leaves fell?
I was happy. I was so happy to get Jay Electronica. He could have been with anybody. I was just glad to hear him. And again, as I say, the wordplay, I think he's one of the best MCs in the game. I didn't think it was going to be this long, but it was well worth the wait, in my opinion.
Well, we will be back with more of our conversation about 2020 in music after a brief word from some of our sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
Hi, it's me, Dave Hill, from before. Here to tell you about my brand new show on Maximum Fun, the Dave Hill Good Time Hour, which combines my old Maximum Fun show, Dave Hill's Podcasting Incident, with my old radio show, The Goddamn Dave Hill Show, into one new futuristic program from the future. If you like delightful conversation with incredible guests, technical difficulties, and actual phone calls from real-life listeners, you've just hit a street called easy. I'm also joined by my incredible co-host, the boy criminal Chris Gersbeck. Say hi, Chris.
Hey, Dave. It's really great.
That's enough, Chris. And New Jersey chicken rancher, Dez. Say hi, Dez.
Hey, Dave.
The Dave Hill Good Time Hour. Brand new episodes every Friday on Maximum Fun.
Plus, the show's not even an hour. It's 90 minutes.
Take that, stupid rules.
We nailed it.
Well, hello. I'm Renee Colvert.
Hi, I'm Alexis Preston, and we are the hosts of Can I Pet Your Dog?
And we got breaking news, we got an exposé, and all the beans have been spilled via an Apple Podcast review that said, this show isn't well-researched. Well, yeah, no duh. Of course it's not. Not since the day we started has it been well-researched. Guessing and anthropomorphizing dogs is what we do.
The Can I Pet Your Dog promise is that we will never do more than 10 seconds of research before telling you excitedly about any dog we see.
I'm going to come at you with top 10 enthusiasm, minimal facts.
We're here for a good time, not an educated time.
So if you love dogs and you don't love research, well, you know what? Come on in to Can I Pet Your Dog podcast every Tuesday on Maximum Fun Network.
Heat Rockers, if you recall back in October, when we were celebrating our third anniversary, we mentioned that we had gotten some custom 45 adapter slash weights made featuring Megan Cott's pin design from last year for Heat Rocks. Well, for a limited time, we have those adapters now available for sale to anyone who wants them. Between now and the end of the year, you can find them through our website at heatrockspod.com. All profits from the sale will be donated to the LA Downtown Women's Center. I need to stress that this is a limited time sale, mostly because we need to make a bulk order to get these produced and shipped back to us from the good folks at the Sure Shot Shop. Again, our special Heat Rocks 45 adapter slash weights are now available through the end of 2020. Visit heatrockspod.com to order. Thank you for supporting us and for supporting the Downtown Women's Center.
And we are back on Heat Rocks, where Oliver and I are talking about some of our favorites from the year that was 2020 in music.
All right, Morgan, you are up next.
My second favorite, as we're talking about artists that came back after a while, after a time away, and maybe that's the theme of this year, because this artist had been gone for 5 years. Her name is Leanne LaHavis, and she came out this year with a self-titled album. This album was one that to me felt full. It felt like a lived experience, a deeply lived experience had happened between the last album and this album. This album is gorgeous. It's a shame that it didn't get the nomination at the Grammys that I thought it well deserved. But tastemakers loved it, heard it on a lot of radio stations, and one of my favorite songs on there is Seven Times. All night and day, all night.
You've got to hold your heart
5 years is beginning to sound like a really long time to be away from any genre. And this was a long time. But this album, like I said, is full. I love her vibrato. I love how she plays. I love how intimate her performances are. She's had a couple of live albums. And I'm sure fans of Leanne LaHavis are aware of those. And this was, you know, well worth the wait. This is her third studio album. It came out in July. And I think the first single that came out was called Paper Thin. And once I heard Paper Thin, I was like, okay, I'm ready. And it lived up to its billing. My other favorite song on there is called Read My Mind.
Mm-hmm. Oh no, you're everywhere that I go, in my head again. Oh, stuck in my head again. Full force, nature taking a course. No need for hide and seek, I'll let you find me.
Now it is sensitive. I mean, it's just the musicality of it. It's just, there's just something about it. And I have to say overall, UK soul has been killing this year without question. Everybody's been saying, what's going on in the UK? The UK's been fire, but they've come to more prominence lately because of some of the placements. I May Destroy You took advantage of a lot of UK soul sounds. Leanne's not new to the game, but it's just nice for her to be to have released this album at a time where UK soul is coming into focus. I've been a longtime fan, but this album was one that I kept playing this year. It really moved me.
For my second choice, and this is not meant to be as much of a self-plug, but it is that one of the albums that I spent the most time with in 2020 was Donny Hathaway's debut album from 1970, so 50 years going, Everything is Everything. And that's because I wrote the liner notes for upcoming, or actually by this time, I think it's actually out now. It's a reissue of the album done for Vinyl Me Please. And so there was a good deal of weeks in the late spring where I was just digging super heavy into everything about not just the album, but also Donny Hathaway's life and career. And it was great. I mean, just be able to revisit and dig into Donny in a way where I'd always admired and enjoyed his music as a listener, loved his voice. You know, many of his songs are amongst some of my favorite soul songs from the 1970s. The first one that comes to mind is his live version of Jealous Guy, which I think is just an all-time great soul performance. But Everything is Everything is not an album that I had ever spent a ton of time with. I don't think it's necessarily his best LP even, especially because it was him coming into his own and he's doing a lot of covers, so it's not necessarily all of his own compositions. But all those things aside, it to me is such an incredibly special album when we think about Donny's life and career up to that point, because its very existence, and this is what I write about in the liners, it really encapsulates the previous half decade from Donny's life, which was really a whirlwind. He went from being a student at Howard University, where he became friends with Leroy Hudson. They were roomed together. Hudson was a dentistry student originally. And of course, Howard is also where Hathaway would meet Roberta Flack, who of course would become his duet partner throughout the 1970s. It's where Hathaway met his eventual co-producer from that first album, Rick Powell. And then he leaves Howard to move to Chicago to work with Curtis Mayfield, which very famously ended up not working out at all, much like Russell Westbrook in Houston, I suppose. But it did set up him going to Chicago, helped to set Donny up with eventually getting signed to Atco Records. And that led to this album being recorded and released. And its very title is a direct nod to Chicago DJ, legendary Chicago DJ Herb Kent, who used to use the catchphrase, "Everything is everything," during his mic breaks in the early 70s.
I'm 8 feet tall. I weigh 132 and a half pounds, very slender. and not really good looking either, but I do play some boss jams. There's no two ways about that. So, you know, what you don't have one way, you kind of compensate for it the other way. Oh, wow. WVON Cicero, everything is everything.
O.C. Smith.
Every album tells a story, but because I had to learn this story, it made me love the album so much more, beyond just the fact that it has some really killer songs on here, and one of my favorites being Hathaway's cover of the jazz ballad standard Misty.
Look at me. Helpless as a kitten up a tree.
Johnny Burke. Shout out to Johnny Burke.
Yeah, seriously. And according to the aforementioned Rick Powell, when he first met Donnie, Hathaway was such a church kid. Powell says that Hathaway only knew three secular pop songs, Misty being one of them. So it's only apropos that this cover of Misty would make its way onto the debut album. So, like I said, I mean, you know, it's self-serving to a certain extent for me to big up this particular album, but I certainly spent a lot of time with Everything is Everything for kind of professional reasons. But as I said a moment ago, it really deepened my personal affection for it, knowing everything about how this album ended up existing to begin with.
The reason that I'm aware of this album is for one song, and that's Thank You, Master, for My Soul.
Ooh.
And that song takes me out.
Thank you for my soul. Lord, thank you. Thank you, Master. Thank you for my soul.
Yeah. Mm.
Telling you, if we weren't recording this right now, I might be on the floor. It's just one of those songs that just hits me so squarely in the chest, you know, and in my soul and spirit. It is a lot of things combined into one song. It is praise, it is worship, and it is Thanksgiving. So I love that. The thing that stands out to me about this album is, man, horns. And we have spent a lot of times over these 3 years talking about various instruments. But man, horns, can you talk a little bit about the musicianships, the musicians on these albums? Because besides Phil Upchurch, I don't know who else was on here.
I'd have to go back to look at my notes to remember who was in the horn section. But certainly it has a very dominant horn section. And you got to remember, I mean, this is Atco's subsidiary of Atlantic, which circa 1969 and 1970, when this album was recorded, Atlantic basically is the main name in town when it comes to R&B production. So we're talking about the best studios, the best studio musicians. They're all at Donnie's disposal to work with. And, you know, it really shines. I mean, the quality of the production on here is so stellar, in addition to just the qualities of the songwriting, which we've talked about. And to say nothing about just, I mean, Donnie's voice is incredible. And it's funny because you so often hear these stories about certain singers, maybe not Aretha, who everyone knew was just as a singer was preternatural. But Donnie, you know, his entry into music, I mean, despite being a child and like a young, like toddler, young gospel singer, by the time he got to Howard, he went there for music education. You know, he was very, you know, very adept at piano, but he didn't think of himself as a performer or as a singer. And so the fact that he has just one of the richest, most distinct voices in the history of R&B music was kind of discovered in a sense by accident. It wasn't something that he cultivated. It wasn't something that others necessarily identified of him until he had these opportunities to gig around the D.C. area as part of the Rick Powell Trio. And people were like, yo, have that kid sing more because he's amazing. Yeah. And to your point, I mean, there are obviously some songs on here that have very overt religious undertones, overtones, whatever, but it doesn't really matter what the most secular of the songs in terms of the basic composition of it, he is still taking you to church no matter what, because Donnie just brings that with him.
Yep.
Let me do
All right, choice number three. What are we up to, Morgan?
You know, before we started taping, I had about 30 choices. And then I was like, you gotta narrow it down just for time. And I went back and forth on this because there were so many great releases. But for me, it was Thundercat. It is what it is. I'm a giant Thundercat fan. I've been with him since the apocalypse, the golden age of the apocalypse. I was with him on Drunk. And the first song that I heard from this album, and I saw the video, was a song called Dragon Ball Durag. And even if I hadn't heard the song, I was like, I just need to know what Dragon Ball Durag is about, right? There was a thread that went viral on Twitter called Durag History. And it was various historical moments that involved, that had durags involved. And so I had to see, I was like, what is this about? As I mentioned at the top, the last concert that I saw before the pandemic was Thundercat. The LA scene is rich with a lot of talents. But I think this is the first time in a long time, in my young life, I like to say that, that it's been supported by what I consider a guitar god or a virtuoso. And that is Steven Brunner, also known as Thundercat. If we could just hear a part of Dragon Ball Durag, I would really be happy about that.
Don't bother me, let me rock you all night long. I'm trying to impress you, girl. Let me know, how do I look in my durag? I'm trying to get intimate. Let me love you like you've never been before, oh, baby.
But I love his humor. I love his voice. I love that his place in the LA scene and his place on big albums, his place on New America, Erykah Badu's one of your favorite albums, his place on the Flying Lotus albums, his place on To Pimp a Butterfly. And this album, I think, is nominated for Best Progressive R&B, which is a new category at the Grammys. But this was an album that when I needed an uplift and I just needed to feel silly, my other favorite on this album is called Qualls, Black Qualls. It's worth saying, not only is this song funky, like extra functified, but if I'm not mistaken, it's going to be part of a super group that he's creating just called Steven, or Steve, because Steve Lacy is on here, Steve Arrington, his name is Steven Brunner. This song features those cats and also Childish Gambino. But much like most of his albums, this has the humor, this has the silly, but this also has this pristine musicianship and this guitar play that he's well known for. 15 tracks on this. King of the Hill is one of the other ones that I love. But as I said to you earlier, there were times where I reserved some albums just for what I needed, just for what I needed to get through this year. And yeah, this was one of them. I thought this was one of the best releases from this year.
I definitely need to go sit with it. The thing about Thundercat that always hits me is that if you were to ask the random music lover, so not just some random person in the street, but someone who loves music, name a contemporary bassist, I feel like that it's hard to come up with anybody, because we oftentimes don't give musicians enough credit. You always the singer. But if they're going to name anybody, it's probably going to be Thundercat. In fact, I can't think of another bassist, contemporary bassist, besides Thundercat. I was going to say, you know, Steve Lacy from the internet, but then I remembered, no, he's a guitarist, not a bassist. So it's like, yeah, it's pretty much just Thundercat. And that says a lot when a bassist has that level of name recognition in our current musical landscape.
The Thundercat, the bass god, and he is definitely the hometown hero.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, for those folks that weren't aware of him before, certainly after To Pimp a Butterfly.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Everybody wanted to know who this cat was.
No doubt.
I hope you'll sit with that one, because this was the one that really gave me smiles throughout the year.
I'm not sure of what's gonna be next, but I'll be all right as long as I keep breathing. I know I'll be all right.
For my last pick, I'm going to go with Run the Jewels 4, which is the, fourth album by Run the Jewels, a.k.a. Killer Mike and LP.
Back at it like a crack. Maddie as a black granddaddy, all back, no capping, fat black, bold captain, stay floating, no flapping, wave runner, I'm a gunner, I'm a head, you block.
I don't think I've spent enough time the last decade singing this pair's praises, so let me just state this for the record. I don't think there has been a more consistent or enthralling hip hop group of the 20 teens than Run the Jewels. I don't think you could quite call them underrated because critics love these two, but I think no matter how much praise gets heaped upon them, and especially with this fourth album, they've gotten a lot, I think it's going to take years for us to observe and acknowledge in hindsight just how accomplished these two have been in their pairing over the years. How about you, Morgan? Are you much of a Run the Jewels fan?
I am. And what separates them from, I think, this generation's hip hop or the now sound of hip hop is tempo. That most of their songs are really driving, they're big, they've got energy, and it sets them apart from sort of the sound of hip hop now, which is slower, which is a little bit more mumbly. I don't mean mumble rappers, but it's very slow and intentional. And I think this is what the game needs. And to me, they're soundtrack ready. For those, you know, big scenes, energetic scenes, scenes with conflict, that's them. So I love them. And this album to me, like all of their albums, is really great. I love the last album. I love one of my favorite songs on here is Ooh La La with Nice and Premier. But I love their sound. And I need to spend some more time with Run the Jewels.
I don't want this to come off as too facile, but in a year where I felt like we should have been inundated with more protest music than I feel like we got, that Run the Jewels, I think, certainly at least filled whatever void there was. And it's not simply because the two of them are talking about rebellion and revolution in their rhymes, but it's because from just a sheer sonic level, their songs make you feel like you are right in the middle of a protest and shit is just about to pop off.
Here come the menaces to sobriety, like what? Super thuggers thumping on a cut. What?
My motherfucking Uzi weighs a ton. Hit the drum till you hear it go, but I'm a bum bum.
Run. Piety just really isn't us. What a rush. See you cutting up a pie. That's my lunch.
I mean, it's like what MOP used to be, let's say 10, 15 years ago. Or me, God, more like 20 at this point. Jesus. Anyways, I mean, I feel like that's that same kind of, you just want to start wrecking shit when you listen to it. And look, Mike and LP as a pair of rappers, you know, they fit together like lock and key. And the way in which they are able to play off one another and just trade rhymes, because we've talked in the past in the show about pairings like Biggie and Jay-Z trading off or Raekwon and Ghost. And I think Mike and LP are as good, if not better, than those previous examples, because their chemistry is just, it's so obvious and it's so volatile. And yeah, here's to another 10 at least RTJ LPs.
100%. And as I said, this is exactly what the game needs. We need that energy. And like I was also saying before, there is no one sound to protest. But to your point, this is one of the sounds of protest because it makes you feel hype. You're ready to get into that battle, to jump in, head first. So shout out to Run the Jewels.
A chubby husky thigh scrubbing, fucking up my Levi's. A crooked copper got the dropper, I put lead in his eye. Plus we heard he murdered a black child, so none of us cried.
Yankee and the brave in here, everybody hit the deck. We don't mean no harm, but we truly mean all the disrespect for.
Morgan, before we wrap up this episode, I wanted to know, looking back, not just in the year in music, but also kind of the year in Heat Rocks, if there was an album that we discussed in any of this year's episodes that felt like either a revelation or perhaps inspired a reevaluation for you. Because for me, I was thinking about this, and this goes back to what I was saying in the first half about how the only really concentrated album listening I did was prepping for our shows every week. And what I really came back to was our episode with Bruno Major, which aired in June, where we discussed Chet Baker's Embraceable You. And I felt like prepping for that, you know, in the week leading up to the episode, I learned more about Chet Baker and his career and his music than I had in the previous 47 years of being on this planet, and really just enjoyed, I mean, obviously Chet Baker's life, very tragic in a lot of ways, but just learning something about an artist that I'd always liked on some level, but had never really dipped into. For whatever reason, that album in particular really stood out to me in terms of, if not for Heat Rocks, I would not have had that experience. And I'm so thankful for having had that experience.
Just one look at you, my heart grows tipsy in me.
I'm wondering for you if there was any albums that, because of our show, it created or inspired you to revisit or just learn about in a profound way that you hadn't done before.
You know what, Oliver, I have to say, our episode with Van Jess talking about Amy Winehouse and Back to Black, to me, was one of those moments where I was like, wow, I'm not going to say necessarily that I learned anything new. I will say that listening to it after Amy had passed took on a whole new meaning for me. Listening to some of those songs and listening to them. I mean, Back to Black came out in 06.
Yeah.
And she died in 2011. So listening to that again struck a more deeply emotional chord for me. I will say one thing that I did learn. I didn't know until we started preparing for that album. I didn't know that Tears Dry on Their Own was written by Ashford and Simpson. I had no clue all those years I've been listening to it. And I was like, ugh. And then sort of talking about some of the production, obviously shouts to Mark Ronson and shouts to Salaam Remy. But just listening to some of those songs and how, and Amy Winehouse's humor mixed in with some of the, you know, some of the sadness. Love is a Losing Game. I mean, just listening back to that with you and with the girls and for, you know, two singers that are younger but are heavily influenced by this album, I think was really a joy to me. And Amy's pen game that I needed to have more respect for. I had spent too much time focusing on her voice and not enough time focusing on the rest of on her pen game and her interpretation of songs. So, like I said, I love that album. That's one of my favorites. But listening to it again, you know, posthumously and with you and with the girls, was one of the good moments for me this year on the show.
Played out by the band.
Along these same lines, I'm really glad you mentioned that Patrice Rushen episode that we taped before lockdown happened. And the album that we discussed was Minnie Riperton's debut, Come to My Garden, which I think if it was not, Embraceable You was the first album that came to mind in answering this question I posed. But I think that would have easily been the second place, very close behind, because I had sat with the album, but never with the same kind of depth that we did in prepping for that. And simply having someone, especially a Patrice, to kind of guide us through her own relationship to Minnie as being someone who had inspired her, even though they're almost close enough in age to be kind of quasi-contemporaries. I just thought that there was so much to learn from Patrice's, how she hears Minnie in that album in particular, and everything that Charles Stepney was doing as the producer and all these things. Even though, and really what I'm trying to say here, and this is another case of, I suppose, patting ourselves on the back, but even if I wasn't listening to a lot of albums in 2020 for all the reasons that I explained at the top of the show, you know, this, our show, right, forces me at least to have to spend at least some time every week listening to an album. And I'm so thankful that to have a reason or excuse or an obligation to do that, just to keep me rooted and engaged and listening at a time in which I think because of all the chaos and despair that have been alternating during the course of 2020, just having that grounding in music and what it symbolizes and the kinds of feelings of hope and possibility that come from it. I'm very thankful for Heat Rocks for giving me that reason to have to sit with this stuff in a dedicated way.
Likewise. And I'm always grateful to spend time With you talking about anything, but
no doubt.
Particularly talking about this music. I also have to say, just for the record, you know, music supervisors feel a way about samples. It makes the hair stand up on the back of our necks. But some of the work that you did, the conversations that you have with Joe Sloss and some of the others, I think took the sting. They were very good episodes and took the sting out of sample use, because, you know, when we hear it, we black out because we're like, oh, God. But those conversations were every music supervisor knows what I'm talking about. You just get scared out there. But these conversations were really beautiful and nuanced and helped me to look at samples in a less than scary way. So thank you for those.
Well, before we really, really wrap up here, is there anything, Morgan, that you're looking forward to in 2021 beyond the end of the pandemic and a new administration coming into power?
I am so interested on a lot of the shows that are being developed and, you know, some of the placements that are going to come out of those shows. That's one. Two, for the artists that have been working on stuff in 2020, I want to see what their output has been and how 2020 has influenced what they will record, what type of albums they will record, what type of songs they will record. And also, I think because of the work you're doing with Donny Hathaway, and that I'm interested in reissues. I'm interested in what decisions are going to go into what albums are reissued this year. And it wouldn't be me if I didn't say that I'd be hopeful for a Sade album. It's been 10 years.
Right.
You know, it's on brand for me to come out. So I'd love to have another Sade album next year. You?
I'm still waiting. As I mentioned earlier, I'm still waiting on that next Frank Ocean project. I'm waiting on that next Kendrick Lamar project. Maybe the two of them plus Sade can just collaborate and just three in one and just give us all, you know, something in a nice tidy package. That sounds like fire.
Yeah.
You know,
for sure.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.